This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Ringgit and Sense on BFM 89.9. The business station.
Good morning, I'm Roshan Kunnison, and you're listening to Ringgit and Sense, the show that's all about personal finance. Now, do you want to invest but just don't know how to start? Well, today on Ringgit and Sense, we're going to talk about how much you need for retirement, simple investing strategies, and active versus passive management. You know, all the fun stuff. Now, to help me with this, I have Wong Wai Ken in the studio. He's the Malaysia country manager for Stash Away. Ken is also a capital market service representative licensed under the Securities Commission. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Morning, Roshan. Thanks for inviting me back on.
Hey, no worries, Ken. Now, remember, you can always let us know what you think on Twitter at either BFM Radio or at Roshan Kunnison. Now, Ken, Let's get straight into the question that everyone has on their minds.
Yep.
How much do I need for retirement?
Yeah, that's a really, really good point, you know, because before you even talk about your investment objectives, you always need to think about what you're investing for. You can't ambiguously think that you want to get rich and be a tycoon. You need to think about concrete objectives and quantify how much you need, right? So it's a major consideration because that determines how much risk you can actually take mm-hmm. before you're investing. So let's just look at facts and figures, where we are today as a nation. So EPF's annual report in 2017 states that someone who is about 54 years old, a year before retirement, only has about 200,000 in their EPF account.
Yeah.
So over the course of 20 years, that's about 900 a month. That's alarming because that's under the minimum wage right now. And if you look at the top 1% of EPF contributors, they have around 700,000 in their accounts. Mm. So to be in the top 1% EPF contribution-wise, you have 700,000. And if you think that's a lot of money and you spread it out over 20 years, say, that's only about 3,000 a month. So that's mm-hmm. barely enough. And we think that, you know, there's a general rule that to retire, you need to retain 70% of your salary upon retirement. So let's say you want to retire with 10K a month or something more realistic, like 8K a month. You'll need about 2 to 2.4 million mm-hmm. in order to retire comfortably. So that's a long way to go.
Yeah, and that 70% is based on the fact that by the time you retire, we hope that you're not paying any more home loans, any car loans, or taxes for that matter, because you take all of that out, you can hopefully live on that net salary.
Yeah, but you also have to consider that, you know, you want to retire comfortably, so mm-hmm. you want to travel. Mm-hmm. You also have to consider the fact that you're old and you might need medical expenses to kick in. So to be at 70%, you need to have some buffer as well. It's some people we talk to actually say that they're not optimistic that their kids will actually contribute towards their retirement. Mm. So it's good to always have that 70% to be self-sufficient.
And that's the other thing, right? Mm. You can't rely on the fact that your kids will be able to afford to support you later on.
Yes.
And that is a consideration for this generation and for the next generation, really.
Yeah.
Because retirement, it's so far away.
Yep.
And if you have an ambiguous goal about how much you want to attain, it's easy to put off, it's easy to not think about.
Yeah. Studies have shown that saving for your retirement is really hard to do because it's so far in the future. It's almost as if you're giving money to a stranger.
Mm.
So people are really reluctant to save for their retirement.
Now, let's try and figure out ways where we can ease that. I've personally found that just systemizing it so you don't think about it, right?
Yep.
Where the money goes automatically into this savings account, this investment tool, it helps with the friction that may come with investing.
Yep.
Now, you know, US stock markets are at all-time highs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some people are not sure. Should they enter the market now? Should they stay out of the market? Should we wait for the dip? What strategies do you have in mind that we can employ to stay in the market or buy into the market but manage our risk better?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Markets are very volatile and will continue to be. I think if we just take a step back and look at markets last year, we had three corrections,
mm-hmm.
one in March, September, and December. So in December, markets went down almost into bad territory. We went down 19.9%, so that was a bit scary. And people thought, you know, this is the harbinger of a bear market. So,
mm-hmm.
but lo and behold, in January, we had the best start to US market in 15 years.
Yeah.
So imagine if you got out in September or December, you wouldn't have enjoyed the rally that we had now. And then in May, that rally was a bit cut short when Trump started those trade wars mm-hmm. with China, India, Mexico. But then the Fed jumped in and signaled that if there was a risk of a recession, they would actually lower interest rates, and that helped the markets rally. And then we just saw over a couple weekends ago or this weekend that Trump and Xi shook hands at the G20. And obviously, that's really good news for China and the US and for Huawei, right? So we think markets have room to run. But to obviously manage your risk, it's really, really hard to time the market exactly when you're going to go in, especially for a retail investor. So before you even begin, you have to think about risk. Mm-hmm. How do you manage your risk? So you have to start with a broad and balanced, diversified portfolio. It should consist of different asset classes across different sectors and geographies. And, you know, for example, the simple fact is that not all sectors and asset classes perform the same way in different economic environments. Consumer staples will perform very different to tech stocks, for example.
And consumer staples are the big consumer companies, things like F&N, Nestle, and of course the tech stocks are the big ones we know, the FANGs.
The FANGs, yeah, absolutely. And not only that, but your portfolio should also have allocation towards bonds. I think as a retail investor, it's hard to get access to bonds because the bite sizes are pretty large. Mm-hmm. But these days, there are different options. You can get access to retail bonds for a lot cheaper and a lower bite size. Because government and corporate bonds offer you portfolio protection, and they give you that buffer against the volatility that you see in the equity markets. So you should really set your portfolio at an appropriate risk level. And once you've invested, be patient, be disciplined, and don't try and time the markets. It's worth spending time in the markets.
Yeah, so that all sounds difficult, right? It's just like, oh my God, these key words, be patient and be disciplined. But you can't run away from something like that.
Yeah.
All you can do is to try to minimize the friction. Personally, for me, I stopped investing in the market when I started working because I didn't have time to think about the volatility that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you start looking at tools and different protocols to help you manage that better. And personally, I found a lot of benefit, or at least it helps me manage the anxiety that comes with investing a little better. Dollar cost averaging.
Yeah.
Now, dollar cost averaging is basically you break up your lump sum and you put it in a little bit each month.
Mm-hmm.
Ken, can you just explain why this strategy is beneficial?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are a fund manager, a digital fund manager at Dashaway. We're huge advocates of dollar cost averaging because we tell people it's really, really hard to time the market as a normal investor, because even institutional investors, the sophisticated investors, find it hard, right? So if you invest steadily over the medium to long term, your frequent investments actually lower the risk that your entry point is concentrated at the peaks of the market. You know, but I also get the question a lot, like we touched on earlier, is now a right time to go in? So that's not actually the right question. It's how you actually stagger your investments. And history and data have shown that no matter when you invest, it beats holding it in cash. Yeah. So let's take the global financial crisis 11 years ago. And if you bought into the S&P 500 index at the very peak before the crash,
right?
And let's say you rode down all the way through the crash, you lost over 50% over the next 2 years. Harrowing stuff, I know. But man, imagine you managed to stay on for the next 10 years, stay invested. Yeah, your investment will still outperform cash by 54%. So it really doesn't matter whether you invest at the peak or the trough. Obviously, everyone wants to invest at the very bottom, but it's very hard to time. So even if you invest at the very top and you ride it out over the medium and long term, you still outperform cash.
Remember, as a retail investor, you're not going to be able to sell at the top and buy at the bottom. All you can really do is manage your strategies. So let's take a look at last December. If you had invested at the start of the month, you would have been in for a little bit of a ride by Christmas Eve when the market had fallen, I think, some 20% by then. Of course, the market corrected thereafter, but let's say it didn't, and you had put all your money in at the start of December, it would take a lot of time for you to rebalance your portfolio over time.
Yep.
As opposed to if you had broken it up into 12 bite sizes in the next 12 months.
Yes.
The key here is that you're diversifying the risk over the timeline. And that's very, very important, especially for retail investors.
Yeah. It sounds very simple, but as long as you follow that method, you won't get concentrated at the very peaks. You're maximizing the likelihood that you will steadily go into the market, spread out your investments, and the performance will take care of itself in the long term.
Yeah. Concentration risk is a very big thing to think about.
Yeah.
Because it's a big commitment to the market at one point.
Yeah.
And it's something that can really impact your portfolio if you put too much money at one go.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you've saved a lump sum of money over the last 12 months and you put it all in the market, let's say today, and the market takes a turn for the worse.
Yeah.
It's going to take a long time to offset that, that impairment to your portfolio.
It's about, sometimes investing is about avoiding losses, huge losses, drawdowns. Because as emotional beings, once we experience something discomforting like a huge drawdown, it's very likely that we'll sell a large chunk or the whole of our portfolio and actually not invest anymore because it's been a traumatic experience and you just give up on investing altogether. And that's obviously not going to bode well for your long-term well-being and your retirement.
And that's what happened in 97 and in 2008 because of that sting that you felt.
That trauma,
And you were talking just now about how if you had stayed invested after 2008, your portfolio would have done better, or at least right now it'd be looking very, very good.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, there is a problem where people have leverage to go into the market. And I cannot emphasize anymore, don't do this because if anything happens, you're on the hook for that leverage.
Yeah. Just coming back to basics, right? You should only invest what you can afford to invest. Don't use your credit cards. Don't take out a loan. Don't borrow money from a friend to invest because you think something is going to be a sure hit. Those things are often too good to be true, and you should only stay invested for the very long term. And that's why if you borrow money to invest, that impairs your judgment, so you can't hold for long term. So again, pro tip, just don't borrow to invest.
In the studio today, I have Wong Wai Ken, the Malaysia country manager for Stashaway. Now, Ken, when it comes to investing, there are generally two giant schools of thought: active management versus passive management. Now, active management is you give your money to fund managers to manage it, and they take a fee off it. And there's a lot of criticism and negativity towards that, but we'll get into that later.
Sure.
Then passive management is you pick an ETF and you just dump your money there.
Yep.
Now, taking into consideration the fees, what reason is there for retail investors to look at active management?
Yeah, I think you're right about active management. They don't really have a good track record consistently beating their benchmarks net of fees. The key word here is net of fees.
Mm.
You always have to take into account the management and entry fees that you pay and consider whether they actually beat their benchmarks. Why are you paying so much for these active managed funds? So according to studies, 92% of US fund managers don't consistently beat their benchmarks net of fees. So the only thing I can think of when it comes to active funds management and whether it's a right investment platform for you, it's if you want very, very specific exposure to an investment strategy or geography that is hard to get through an index fund or an ETF. So for example, if you want Malaysian small caps, an actively managed fund may suit you because small caps have the chance to outperform and it might give you good returns over the long term if you stay invested in that risky asset class, but make sure it's always net of fees. So in 2007, Warren Buffett did a bet with a basket of hedge funds, and he bet $1 million that an index fund would actually outperform over the course of 10 years. And sure enough, the S&P 500 index returned 7% compounded versus the actively managed funds, which only gave 2.2%. I think the time period here is important because he started in 2007, just before the financial crisis.
Yep.
So again, it's about that long-term ability to give you consistent returns.
And that hits the nail right on the head, right? Fund performance or investment performance has to be benchmarked against the market. The market is generally the S&P 500 or whatever basket of stocks that you're looking at. But generally speaking, we look at the S&P 500 because it's the collection of the 500 biggest companies on earth, right? Or at least in the US.
In the US, yeah.
And how they performed over the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So if the S&P 500 did 30% in the last year, let's say in the last 6 months, but your fund is doing 10%, then you are underperforming the market.
Yep.
And in that case, it would have been so much better if you had just taken a low-cost ETF.
So in theory, an active fund manager could adapt to their market environment and actually try and outperform the market by shifting their portfolio. But as we mentioned, the fees really kick in, and net of fees, do they really stack up to just being invested in a passive platform.
Yes, and again, fees. That's the most important thing you've got to keep an eye on. Take a look at all the different fee structures before you invest in any product.
Yep.
Now, again, let's address the elephant in the room for a second.
Sure.
Now, you are from Stashaway, Malaysia,
sure. Yep.
And obviously you are competing with active managers in that scene.
Yeah, absolutely.
So aren't you kind of like an active manager as well?
So at Stashaway, we actually use the best of both passive and active investments. So when the markets are, when the economic environment is stable, we actually don't churn your portfolio, meaning we don't trade in and out of different securities or asset classes. We remain invested in a basket of ETFs that we design for your risk level. But for example, when we go from good times to a recession and we have to adjust your asset allocation, in that instance, we'll make your portfolio a lot more defensive. And throughout that recessionary period, your portfolio will remain passive. So at the right moments, we are active. And throughout the steady state, we'll be passive. So we combine the best of both worlds.
So a typical ETF with Vanguard is something like 0.5% per annum.
Mm-hmm.
And the typical active manager is about 1.8%, 2%.
Mm-hmm.
Stashaway, if I'm not wrong, is about 0.8% per annum.
Yeah.
In all honesty, that's a pretty good rate, but it's still 0.3% more expensive than a ETF.
Yeah, so it's actually possible for anyone to actually go and buy ETFs in their own right. But I think the value added for us is that we've already curated the portfolio which contains these ETFs, which we've screened according to our criteria to form portfolios for your risk level, right? So that is our value add. And like I mentioned earlier, the sophistication comes in when we adjust your portfolio during economic cycles, when they come and go and they change. So your portfolio should never be static, because in your life, you go through 6 or 7 different economic environments and you want your portfolio to be dynamic. If you're static, it's very, very likely that in a crisis, your portfolio will be drawn down massively and you will actually end up being very emotional and sell and not stay invested for the long term. So that's our value add as an actual fund manager. Firstly, we curate the ETFs for you into a portfolio, and then we manage that money for you in these portfolios through different economic times.
Okay, so I want to just clarify here. This is not an endorsement of Stashaway.
Sure.
And that whatever it is, when you're investing, you got to take a look at your options. Active managers are an option for you. ETFs are an option. Increasing your EPF allocation is an option. And yes, robo-advisors are an option as well. The things you got to consider are fees, your goals, and whether you want it to be actively or passively managed. So now to wrap up this episode of Ringgit & Sense, it all comes down to knowing why you want to invest. If that's retirement, then stick to that plan. Do it for the long term. Then allocate how much you want to invest every month and come up with automatic ways to do it. Dollar cost averaging is a very valuable strategy to use. And at the end of the day, active management or passive management or robo-advisories or EPF, these are all different tools. So just assess them and match them against your goals. And most importantly, take a look at how much they cost you, because 1% or 2% in fees compounded over time can make a difference. On that note, we'd like to thank you for joining us today, Ken. Today on the show, I had Wong Wai Ken, Malaysia Country Manager of Robo-Advisory Stashaway. Now, if you'd like to learn more about ETFs, check out my digital-only conversation with Ken on the BFM app or on Spotify. Just look up Ringgit & Sense. This was Ringgit & Sense, the show that's all about personal finance. I'm Roshan Kanesan, signing off for The Morning Run. Up next is the 10 a.m. News Bulletin and then Enterprise, BFM 89.9.
Ringgit & Sense on BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.